Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And we are live on tape from Dublin and Belfast. This is the fourth part of our ongoing look at Alan Klein and his involvement in the Beatles world. In a sense of Groundhog Day, we are back at May the 9th, 1969, which is known traditionally as Liberty Bell Day, or in Stephen's universe, Liberty Bell Day Part 2. And in Friday, May the 9th, Paul McCartney is expected to sign a binding contract between the Beatles and Alan Klein. The previous day has seen a legal lackey travel from Beatle to Beatle to try and get them to put their signatures on a carbon copy document that is binding for Mr. Klein. I don't understand this legal mumbo-jumbo, Stephen. I'm vaguely...
This is a typical day in a lawyer's life where you're scuttling around making manuscript amendments at the last minute to contracts. All in a day's work.
Oh, yes, and charging by the hour, and all of it going onto the Apple tab. Good times.
Plus expenses. What we should say is this contract, it will not be binding until ratified at a formal board meeting of Apple.
Yes, now this is an important thing to remember, that even if Paul signs it straight away, even if he signed it first, this ratification has to happen. Park that thought, because it plays an important part in a few moments. So this day is a day that, perhaps because there's been a control of the narrative by Paul in recent years, particularly when we come to things like the anthology and books like Many Years From Now, people are able to ask him questions about this day and what happened. You know, when John was around, these kind of in-depth things weren't really known as facts. And so I don't think we got John's take on what happened at around that time. He speaks in vague generalities about Alan Klein, but we now know because Paul's been asked about this day and he's very clear about what went down at that time. So what did go down on May the 9th when they went to get Paul's signature?
Well, the Beatles have convened at Olympic Studios and they are there to listen to the latest Glyn Johns, some would say terrible, mix of some Get Back tracks. So they're still, this project has resurrected itself and they're listening to mixes. The Beatles are there, Neil Aspinall is there, Klein is not there, we should say. Klein is at the airport waiting for his flight back to New York. And once they've listened to these tracks, Paul is presented with this contract that everyone else, the other three, have signed the day before. And they're saying, right, Klein has been working for 3 months or more without a contract. We're in the middle of the negotiations for Northern Songs. He needs to have authority. He needs to be sure you have to sign this contract. Now, remember, this is a contract that has previously been discussed.
Yes.
If you remember, a few days earlier, they have a meeting, Klein exits, they all discuss this. Peter Doggett makes the point that no one in that meeting was objecting to Klein's appointment, much less, in Peter Doggett's words, objecting to the proposal that Klein would get 20% as his fee. Paul, presented with the document, says, I'm not signing this. I want my lawyer to have a look at this, and therefore I will not be able to get to this until Monday.
Yes. That's now, in a functional relationship, that's not the most unreasonable request, you know.
No.
I've got this to do. Just give me a day or two to revise it, look at it, think of it. The bit that Paul talks about is this kind of 15 to 20% change, that he uses that as his reason to kind of dodge signing on the Friday.
Yes. I mean, he does talk about this a lot. So in Anthology, he says, the other three said, you've got to sign a contract. Klein's got to take it to his board. And I said, well, it's Friday night. He doesn't work on a Saturday. Anyway, Alan Klein is a law unto himself. And they said, you're stalling. He wants 20%. And I said, tell him he can have 15%. And they said, you're stalling. And I said, no, I'm working for us. We're a big act. I remember the exact words. We're a big act. The Beatles. He'll take 15%. But for some strange reason, I think they were so intoxicated with him. They said, no, he's got to have 20% and he's got to report to his board. You've got to sign it now or never. So I said, right, that's it. I'm not signing now. So he draws a line in the sand. They draw a line in the sand. In Paul's words, they're saying, you've got to sign now or never. Yeah.
And, you know, having seen the Get Back film and the way Paul interacts with Michael Lindsay-Hogg versus how the others interact with Michael Lindsay-Hogg, that kind of, you know, in charge, authoritative kind of voice that he has when you see those interactions.
Yeah.
You can totally imagine this kind of situation going down that Paul is saying, no, wait a second. You could argue he's totally reasonable. I they were a big act. They were.
They were. There's pretty no big. Denying that. They were a big
act. He's not lying. They were a big act. They still are.
The Beatles and Cilla, that was pretty much it.
That's it, yes.
I think there's a couple of ways to look at this. I think, yes, it's perfectly reasonable that everybody has to be happy with this contract. But this is a contract that has previously been discussed.
Yep.
Paul has been there, has raised no objection. And if you remember, Paul is at that previous meeting with his lawyer.
And he didn't say anything about 15% or 20%
no.
at that time. And,
no.
yes.
What I was going to say is this does ring a bell in terms of Paul's early interactions with Brian Epstein.
Yes.
Where Paul is the one who's kind of being a little bit, you know, there's that famous tale where he's in the bath and
yes.
They turn up for their meeting. Paul is late. Paul is in the bath and George says, well, you know, he may be late, but he'd be very clean. But it is that there's sort of history there in Paul's attitude or to people in a management figure. It would be, I can tell you as a lawyer, it would be incredibly frustrating to think you'd gone through all of this, you'd run around, you'd got everything, and then somebody who was in the meeting simply changes their mind. They're entitled to change their mind. Of course they are. But he is one of four directors, maybe more directors, but one of the directors in a company. And he's entitled to be satisfied. But,
yeah.
You know.
But he's also, though, you kind of see in the Get Back film that he is apologetic for being this kind of leading figure. And since Mr. Epstein's died and all the rest, he's had to carry the can.
Mm.
And he still feels, I think the other three are you could argue, are saying, well, look, we found this guy, Klein. He's going to carry the can.
Yeah.
And Paul is like, oh, am I the last man standing? Now, the flip side of that is, given all the things we've discussed in the previous two episodes, in terms of some of Paul's other slightly dodging behaviours or dismissive
yeah.
behaviours, that the others could be saying, well, Paul, could you just stop being a dick and just sign it and just stop doing this every time we put something to you? Like that you can also see them, why they would feel that way.
Yes, and I do have a sense, there is a sense that the other three, possibly at Klein's instigation,
yeah.
have sort of chosen this moment to, you know, hold Paul's feet to the flame and say, you've got to make up your mind, you've got to sign, this is what we all want to do, you've got to put your pen to the paper. But it is this idea that Paul is not putting up logical reasons. You know, you can see that he's saying, oh, well, you know, maybe we could chip away, but the time for chipping away
yeah.
and negotiating the fine print has sort of passed, and it's got to the stage where three of the people that need to sign this have already signed it.
Yeah, but Paul would say, oh, well, this is just tactics, and, you know, we are a big act, and, you know, they're both playing tactics, so they're trying to do this Friday-type signing, and Klein is playing this totally bogus row that John, George and Ringo believe, which is, oh, I have to get it back to the Alan Klein board straight away, and Paul is saying, they can wait, and Paul is right.
I'm not sure that they do believe that Klein. They know Klein. They know Klein has no board. I don't think
yes.
they necessarily believe that. I think this is just the moment that the three of them, or possibly the four of them, if we include Klein, have decided this is the moment when we have to definitively get a yes or a no. We have to actually basically call Paul's bluff. He's been dancing around. The time to deploy this tactic would have been at the earlier meeting when Klein has left and they're all sitting
yeah.
around, and Paul should have been saying at that point, 20% is too much. He should take 15. He was there. He was in the room. He had his lawyer. And I think it's a level of miscommunication.
Yeah.
And that is the biggest sort of tell as to how bad, how dysfunctional the relationship has become. I have said before, I don't think Paul is good at reading a room.
Yes.
You know, there are lots of examples of that. Lennon is fired up. You know, Paul uses the word intoxicated. I think Lennon is intoxicated with Klein. I think George and Ringo are accepting Lennon's lead.
Yep.
But Paul is not playing his hand well and has not played his hand well. And all of this plays out against the background of what I had described as Liberty Bell,
yeah,
part one,
yep,
where suddenly Paul won't put his shares up. Everybody else is in. This is to secure the loan that will get them Northern Songs, and Paul is going, I'm not doing it.
Yeah. And you know, the other three are kind of set against the Eastmans at this point, and we don't know what they're saying behind closed doors about the fact that the Eastmans are now, he's now married to Linda.
Yes.
And so they probably feel, well, Paul can't be logical. Paul is getting blindsided. You know, Klein is kind of neutral to us and he's for us. That's, you know, legitimately what they would have said. I mean, to go back to many years from now, you know, Paul is kind of saying, as you said, they were besotted by the guy, and he's saying, no, he wants a good deal. We shouldn't run and jump into his arms. And because the Eastmans weren't going to be practicing on Friday and Saturday, he was using this to put a fudge into getting things done on Monday.
Yep.
I happen to have a Jewish lawyer, said Paul. What can I say to him? Change your bloody religion, man. I need you. Classic. You can't do that. And they said, we will do it without you, which they couldn't. And that was why they needed me. Otherwise, I don't think they would have bothered showing up. So they said, oh, fuck off. And they all stormed off, leaving me with the session at Olympic. We're now two swears in this episode, Stephen. We'll have to put an E on the... Sorry if anyone's driving there with their kids. So it's... You know, we're laughing about it, but this is tense and this is a scar for Paul to this day.
Yes. And the one aspect of this that I have, all my sympathies are with Paul. Mm-hmm. What happens is Klein is at the airport and Klein comes back from the airport to make the case to Paul. And there is a massive, massive row between Klein and Paul. And Glyn Johns is there. He was a witness to this, and he describes it in terms of Klein actually physically intimidating Paul and bullying him and shouting at him. And, you know, he says that, you know, he's in the control room. This is happening down on the studio floor. He turns all the microphones off so that he can't actually hear what is happening. But he said even with the mics and everything off, he can still hear the shouting and the bullying. And he describes it in those terms. So it has descended into that, almost like a physical confrontation. And there are shades of that physical confrontation that Lennon has had with him previously when he suddenly finds out about the additional shares. So Paul, I think rightly, even if he were going to sign the contract, Klein would be his employee. And he is having a potential employee screaming at him in the studio, a place where he feels safe, a place where the Beatles have always, as you said previously, they're able to put all their kind of business things to one side. They're in a studio, they make music, and they can forget about the business stuff. Suddenly the business stuff is in his face, in his studio.
And it's May 1969. He's Paul McCartney. He didn't know this guy 4 months earlier. And now he's screaming at him, telling him what he has to do. And, you know, famous people shouldn't be treated that way. I don't mean they shouldn't be treated that way, but they're not used to being treated that way.
He's
certainly
not
used to being treated that way. And that is not acceptable.
It isn't acceptable, and that's why I'm saying this is the aspect of that day, this second, if you will, Liberty Bell day, where my sympathies are with Paul. He is being berated by somebody, but on the other hand, Klein would say he's trying to do his best for the Beatles. He's trying to get them control of Northern Songs. It is a very difficult situation, and he is not being given sufficient authority to go out there and do that. Paul is, in a sense, having his cake and eating it too. He is quite happy for Klein to go out, do the deal, conduct a negotiation, but he's not prepared to give him his official authority to do that.
And so what happens next is everyone storms out. Paul is left alone in the studio.
Yeah.
And he's there for a few hours. But what's more striking is what happens behind his back when he's left behind, or what they, well, behind his back maybe isn't the phrase.
Well, it's very emotive. It's very emotive.
Okay.
It's like, so, well, it's interesting that if you, that quote that you had from many years from now, and they said, well, we'll do it without you, which they couldn't. That was why they needed me. Otherwise, I don't think they'd have bothered showing up.
Yes.
They didn't need him.
No, they did not. They didn't need his signature at all. They were humouring him.
What they needed was a board meeting at which three directors of Apple were present. So at 8 p.m. that evening, John, George, and Neil Aspinall, who was a director of Apple, hold a board meeting and ratify the agreement with Klein. And that is something that they were perfectly entitled to do under the company rules. So, as a lawyer, from a legal perspective,
are
Klein,
you a lawyer? This is news.
Klein,
you've said it twice now.
Has a binding contract with Apple, and it is irrelevant from a legal perspective that Paul has not signed this document. And Paul will say, "I never signed. He doesn't represent me." It's true, he does not represent Paul in Paul's personal capacity, but he is now the officially, legally appointed representative of Paul's company, Apple.
Yeah, and I don't mean to be emotive by using a phrase, but behind his back. But did he know that they were stomping off to do this, or do we know if he knew?
I think not. I mean, I think there is a massive row. They leave. You know, Klein is back. There is this row. It descends into this almost sort of physical bullying of Paul, and then everybody leaves. And Paul does not leave the studio. So I don't think he could have known that this was going to happen. I think, and I'm speculating here, but I think it is probably telling that Ringo is not at this board meeting. So maybe Ringo is slightly less comfortable doing this.
Well,
Klein will no doubt have been pointing out to them, well, we don't need Paul's signature. You don't need Paul's signature. You just need to have a board meeting. And a board meeting can take place anywhere. It's just like, you know, three people not riotously assembled, and they have their board meeting and they sign the document. They ratify it, and that's it.
They reach their quorum. There's a good quote here from George where it says, it's more of a personal thing, you know, the management situation, because Apple was Paul's idea, which is an interesting thing to say. I don't think it was Paul's idea per se. Maybe it suited Paul the most. Was it purely his idea, do you think?
Well, I think it's sort of originally, it's really Paul and John. If you look at those early days, it's Paul and John. And George, I have to say, after the event, although this is not, this is more of a contemporary quote, but certainly an anthology, George is very good at distancing himself from Apple. So in the early days, I think it is principally John and Paul. It's
this
their
kind
idea.
Of Western communism idea. Anyway, he says Apple was Paul's idea. And once he started going, he was very active in there. And then it got very chaotic. Then once we tried to start doing something about Apple, obviously Paul didn't have as much say in the matter. And then because he wanted Lee Eastman, his in-laws, to run it, and we didn't, it soon became a problem. That's a personal problem that he will have to get over. The reality is that he's outvoted and we are a partnership. Ouch, that has never been the case before, this event.
No.
You know? So Paul is left alone in the studio, and Paul is, as Paul does, what does he do?
He records a song.
He records a song. Not a Paul McCartney song, but a song by a visiting musician who sticks his head around the corner, Steve Miller.
Steve Miller, hey, what's happening, man? Can I use the studio? Yeah, I said, can I drum for you? I just had a fucking unholy... Oh, God, that's a third one.
That's
a fucking unholy argument with the guys there. I explained it to him. Took minutes, 10 minutes to get it off my chest. So I did a track. He and I stayed that night and did a track of his called My Dark R. I thrashed everything out on drums. There's a surfeit of aggressive drum fills. That's all I can say about that.
Yeah, and it's a nice song. It's neither remarkable nor unremarkable. It's okay, you know. It's on his, what's the name of the album it's on? It's on his Brave New World album, isn't that it? Yeah. And, you know, it's a second person from the cast of characters of Flaming Pie. We've had Allen Ginsberg, and now we've got Steve Miller, who appears on Flaming Pie many years later.
He's most famous for appearing on Flaming Pie.
Well, I think so. It's funny that, you know, for the post-anthology Beatles revival record. He's like, and here's from my finest moment, it's, Steve yeah. Miller. Let's remember all the good times.
Like, this is your life.
this song exists, and you know it's very Paul to retreat into the studio and record a track.
Yes, and he hides behind a pseudonym.
Yes, and
Paul,
it's a Beatley pseudonym.
Ramon.
Ramon. Yes.
Ramon.
Which is the pseudonym he's used before in 1960 while they were touring Scotland as the Silver Beatles. He was Paul Ramon, and obviously, you know, good old conspiracy theory. It's partly to do with the song Ramon as well. It's what gave us the name of the group, The Ramones.
Yeah, it's all connected.
The point is that this is ratified. Klein now has an element of authority and control. He can act on their behalf. There's still the unfinished business of Northern Songs.
Yes.
That's the next big problem.
Yes, this is all still going on in the background, and we kind of touched on this. So basically, Dick James has and Charles Silver have sold out to ATV. They've got around, 30-35% of the shares. The Beatles have just short of 30. There's a rush, there's a competition to see which of the sides can get control of the remaining shares, which are floating around. So by April, May, ATB have got 35% of the shares. So they've been buying these up. Meanwhile, back at the stock exchange, a selection of stockbrokers do what stockbrokers do, and they have formed a consortium called The Consortium.
That's very like
they've bought
a prisoner.
15% of the stock. So if ATV can get the shares from the consortium and a couple of more shares, they're home in a boat and they've got control of the company. So that is where things sit. There are two competing bids. ATV bid is sitting at under £2 a share. Klein has put an offer out at just above £2 a share. But the consortium don't like Alan Klein, and they don't like his reputation. You remember he's been trashed in the Sunday Times. They're nervous that Klein will be controlling this company.
Mm.
And they don't trust him.
But why should that matter? I'm not a financial whiz kid. If they're getting rid of the shares, why do they care who's running the company once they sell the shares?
I rely on you not being a financial whiz kid. That's why I look after all of the end. Nothing is real petty.
Oh, thanks, man.
I think what the intention is at this stage is that the consortium will not sell their shares necessarily, but will enter into some sort of cooperation agreement.
Gotcha.
They will sort of pledge their support, but
yes,
they will retain their shares. So rather than take a capital payout for their shares, they will enter into a shareholders agreement or some kind of arrangement with the Beatles, and they'll continue to get income.
Yeah, so they'll own their bit, but they will let it be run by the other major shareholders, either ATV or Klein Beatles. But they don't want Klein to be the man with his hands on the till, hands on the reins, whatever kind of metaphor you want to use.
That's it.
Okay, so, you know, one of the things we touched upon in the last episode is how, while all of this is happening, then stuff sort of pops into their day-to-day calendar where they're just acting totally normally. So 4 days after the big Liberty Bell collapse, they're in Manchester Square at EMI's main offices, leaning over the balcony, getting their photo taken. Eventually, you know, we see it on the Blue album. It's planned for the cover of Get Back, but, you know, they're all smiles. They're all mad into it.
There's a camera. So,
yeah,
again, it's this business as usual to, facing out to the world.
Yeah.
What you also have to remember is the world is watching. You know, the financial press is watching this. The music press is watching this. The people are speculating, you know, are they all falling out? Are they going to split up? And so there's a lot of focus on them. And they're doing photo shoots. They're also doing interviews.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to read this quote. So there's another swear coming up. In the middle of negotiations, see what I did there? John made his comment, "I'm not going to be fucked around by men in suits sitting on their fat arses in the city."
Now, that wasn't a wise thing for John to say, because...
It really was not.
If this consortium already had concerns about Klein, you know, being in control of, you know, the future of Northern Songs, to have a John Lennon as the main breadwinner to be kind of going rogue and saying things like that, what it eventually does is that, you know, 6 days after the Manchester Square photo is taken, eventually the consortium make their decision and it gets announced that they're going to partner with ATV.
Yes, and they do enter into this cooperation agreement. So basically it's a time-limited cooperation agreement. So what they've signed up to is that they will pledge their 15% to ATV between the 19th of May and 1969 and May 1970. So effectively it's a 12-month cooperation agreement between ATV and the consortium. So they haven't sold the shares, they're just supporting Lou Grade. So they could, for example, vote him onto the board, and they have the sort of firepower to do that.
So the door is open for, because the consortium still own the shares as a block. So it's not, it's an agreement, but it's not a done deal, and ATV don't have the ultimate ownership, which gives Klein a little bit of wiggle room for what he tries to do next. And again, this notion of life in Beatleland continues. John and Yoko go to Toronto for, you know, the Toronto bed-in, where Give Peace a Chance is recorded. So, you know, perhaps maybe the more famous of the bed-ins. That same week, the Ballad of John and Yoko single comes out. So if you're not a big old Beatles nerd in 1969, you just think, oh, here's a new single from the Beatles. Ooh, it's got the word Christ in it. And, you know, it's Franco is a bit upset and all of that kind of stuff. It's, you know, it's just normal business. Which then kind of tilts off into the summer.
And they do what Beatles do. They all go on holiday.
On holiday. So not much happens in June.
Not together.
No.
John and Yoko are in Toronto, and Paul, George and Ringo all go off on separate holidays. And this is supposedly when Paul decides we need to do another album. We need to, you know, we can't kind of leave it like this. There's so much unfinished business. We need to do an album like we did in the old days. And then he contacts George Martin. He gets buy-in from the others. Although, interestingly, John had already given an interview about the song medley way back in April. So that's a kind of, that notion is still hanging around from the end of the Get Back project. But the big kind of key date then is 1st of July. They start the sessions for Abbey Road.
Yeah, it's very interesting, that kind of little break in June, because as you say, they all go away, get a holiday, clear their heads, do a bed in, whatever you like to do when you're on your holidays. And it is another one of these kind of canon discussions that, you know, this notion of, you know, Abbey Road was intentionally the last album. I don't...
No.
Like, certainly Ringo doesn't think that's true. But it's now kind of sold as this notion of, oh, well, we'll just do one more. We can't leave it like this. In retrospect, we are fortunate, and it is fortunate that that's how it played out, that they got it together, they sealed the deal, they made this album, and someday we'll do Abbey Road-specific episodes. But it is kind of part of this kind of canon or this lore that we call George Martin, and George Martin says, only if you let me produce you like you, I used to produce you, chaps, boys, I don't like your tie, whatever. And that they all plan to go into Abbey Road. But, of course, a chunk of Abbey Road already exists at this point. They've been recording in bits and pieces since the end of January.
I think the importance of the 1st of July is not so much that it's the beginning of the Abbey Road sessions, but it marks the end of Get Back. You know, it's the point at which the slightly desultory sessions that have been going on since the end of January, beginning of February, with no particular, you know, idea in mind, suddenly coalesce around this idea. Right, it's an album. It's not the Get Back album. It's an old-fashioned Beatles and George Martin album. And this, as you say, June seems to have given everybody a chance to decompress slightly. Klein, you know, Paul, whether he likes it or not, Klein is off in the background negotiating with people, doing what he does.
So I think, you know, the take-home message from that June 1969 period is that it's always a good idea to take a break. Wouldn't you agree?
End of part one. Intermission. End of intermission. Part 2.
Welcome back. So we are at the 1st of July, 1969. This is the official beginning of Abbey Road, even though we've got bits of You Only Give Me Your Money and yeah. I Want You, She's So Heavy and all the rest are floating around. This is the official sessions. John is not there because there's been a car accident and yep. The other three Beatles are recording without him. Again, we will do an Abbey Road episode. It's on the to-do list forevermore. But, you know, John reappears just over a week into sessions. You know, he brings Come Together with him. He also brings a bed to put his wife into. That's a good idea. 1969, an awful lot of beds involved.
It's the third bed in.
It kind of is the third bed in. It's like a little personal bed in yeah. for the lads down in number two. It's great.
You know, to make them feel included. You know, this is...
Yeah, so it's fine. And in the middle of all of this, and, you know... I'm pretty certain people listening to this podcast have heard the album Abbey Road. You know, it works out pretty well. But in the middle of all of this, they're pulled off to see a rough cut of a little movie called Chex Notes Get Back.
Yes. So, you know, poor Michael Lindsay Hogg is still, you know, standing around forlornly, clutching his cigar. Yeah, do I have a movie? Do I not have a movie? Are we going to put this out? Are we not going to put this out? So it's still kind of there in the background. We should get Michael Lindsay Hogg on and ask him what he was doing in June. Did he go off on a holiday as well?
I wonder, did they look at that you know, movie? Because it's only 6 months earlier. And as we've said before, that's an eon in Beatles time. Did they look back and think, oh man, we were so happy back then. You know, now we're not happy. But back then we were happy.
Little did they know.
But then we enter into August, September, and these are two pivotal Beatle months. So, August, talk us through August.
There's a lot happening in August, so we'll just rattle through this. So, there are sessions. The cover shoot is on the 8th of August. The last recording session is on the 20th of August. The last mixing session is on the 21st of August. The last photo shoot, which produces the Hey Jude album cover, is on the 22nd of August. The 28th of August, Mary McCartney is born. And on the 30th, John, George and Ringo are all watching Bob Dylan at the Isle of Wight. And then it's September.
But, you know, they've gotten a lot done in July and August. They've closed out an excellent album. They've done all the attendant, you know, photography and design work.
Sequencing
and all the rest.
Yep.
You know, so stuff is happening. Now, we are lucky, you know, the famous story of Abbey Road is that they're like, oh, we'll just go outside and take our photo. You know, these kind of very quick, random decisions. We are not spending weeks getting Peter Blake to assemble a montage, or we're not hanging out in Richard Hamilton's studio to get things done. It's literally, let's just take a photo and be done with it. But there's still this ongoing, you know, Klein still has a notion of getting his oar in to try and somehow salvage something out of Northern Songs.
Yes, so there have been two approaches. So the consortium are linked to Lou Grade until May 1970. So Klein, first of all, goes to them and says, well, look, you know, when that agreement comes to an end, we'll buy your shares, or we're still interested. So Lou Grade will have control for 12 months. That's not the end of the world, and we will buy these shares. Meanwhile, he also approaches Lou Grade. And there's a very good book called Apple to the Core, The Unmaking of the Beatles, which really covers this period. It was written in the early 70s, so it's quite a sort of fresh and current perspective. Yeah. And there's a quote from Jack Gill, who was the financial director at ATV, and he says, Klein came to see Sir Lou with vague terms under which he would see to it that we got control of Northern by delivering the Beatles shares to us. At that time, he was there to knock the consortium. The main concession was that Apple would then get sub-publishing rights for the Beatles songs throughout the US and Canada. We were willing to consider it, but told Klein that we were not in a position to do so at the time because of our agreement with the consortium. So what Klein seems to be saying is, well, look, okay, we'll deliver the shares, the Beatles shares, to you. Now, it's unclear if that means he's going to sell them or he's going to enter into some kind of agreement, cooperation agreement. And in exchange for that, there would be a sub-publishing deal for the US and Canada.
It's an interesting idea, and it's one that you kind of think, well, why didn't ATV and the Beatles figure out a way to actually work together to get the job done as a group. And so, Klein, this is actually not a bad idea to say, yeah, let's come together, like the song says, hey? And we will, you know, Northern Songs will still exist, and we'll take the North American publishing, and we'll make a bit of money off that, and you'll make a bit of money off the rest of the world, and we'll both have control, and we'll figure it out. It's not the worst idea.
Everything is hunky-dory, everything is going completely according to plan, and it's a very good deal. And then? The Eastmans write a letter to Lou Grade saying, Klein does not represent or speak for Paul McCartney.
Oh,
so what Eastmans. Is going on here? What is this about?
Well, it's so bad that Paul withdraws the letter and gives a very direct apology to Lou Grade saying, Klein does speak for me. And when Paul is doing that, you kind of have to think, oh man, we're through the looking glass here.
So is this the Eastmans going off on a solo run? Because one of the things that characterises all of this is there is such personal animosity between the Eastmans and Klein. And you get the sense when you look at the transcripts and you sort of read people's differing accounts, even Paul's accounts of the meetings at which the Eastmans and Klein come to blows, the Eastmans are genuinely riled up. Klein is doing it for fun. You know, this bounces right off. This is water off a duck's back. He doesn't care what you say about him. He does not care about the insults, but he knows how to get under the Eastman's skin. And there is such a level, I think, of personal animosity. Why would they write and on the cusp of that deal and say, well, Klein does not have authority? He does have authority because he does have authority. And the fact that Paul has to phone Lou Grade, just by way of background, the Beatles don't like Lou Grade. They really don't like Lou Grade, and they don't like the whole kind of the Grade family. There are two or maybe three brothers, and there was a Leslie Grade they believed that had sort of actively worked against them in the early days because Brian hadn't sort of gone into a deal with Leslie Grade, who was a sort of a promoter back in the early 60s. And they felt that the Grade family were really against them and had done them down. That's right. Yeah. So it's quite a big thing for Paul to phone Lou Grade and apologise.
Yeah. So ATV, which is the Grades, you know, they have the situation where they own about 35%. They have about 15% from the consortium. They're still not exactly, they're kind of hovering around this 50%. They're not quite there. It's a bit tight. And as a business, the story goes that their own share price is quite low that summer. They don't have a lot of cash on hand. And they want to try and actually just buy out the consortium and get it done. And, you know, then they can, you know, get everybody on board and sort it out and have a bit of power. And the consortium itself, though, is a bit kind of chaotic. The consortium ends up falling apart, really.
Yeah, so by early September, this consortium is just that. It's a collection of individual shareholders, and some of them start to get a bit nervous about all of this, and they say, well, we're just going to sell our shares. And part of the agreement that the consortium has with ATV and sort of between themselves, between all of these shareholders, is that if any member wants to sell, they will offer their shares first to the other members of the consortium. So eventually this is what happens, and it starts to fragment. And ultimately, by the 8th of September, ATV is able to say, we now have 38% ownership. And they are dealing with a chap called Peter Donald, who was the chairman of an entity called Hard and Wyndham, that was one of the largest members of the consortium. And so he is then now entering into direct negotiations with Lou Grade and Jack Gill. So this is, we're kind of into the second week in September. And while all this is going on, John and Yoko are remixing the new smash hit Plastic Ono Band single, What's the New Mary Jane?
Yes, which obviously doesn't see the light of day until many anthologies later. But there is this thing again, Beatles business as usual. In September, there's a launch party at the start of September in Apple for Abbey Road, and Paul turns up to that. There's very, very few pieces of press and interviews that happen for Abbey Road at the start of September. As you say, John and Yoko are fiddling around with What's the New Mary Jane, because they want to put out another Plastic Ono Band single following on from Give Peace a Chance. And the day after, they're mixing that single. Somebody says, let's go to Toronto and do some rock and roll. And they go, that's a fantastic idea. And the 13th of September, John and Yoko are doing their rock and roll thing, live piece in Toronto. And the legend, it's not the legend, the truth goes, is that it's on this trip on the plane that John decides, I'm not a Beatle anymore, but he keeps it under his hat for the moment.
Yeah. Apple is continuing. So, interestingly, it's back to that quote that George had, where Paul is sort of withdrawing from Apple, and George actually becomes, you know, John is still there, but John and Yoko are doing the John and Yoko thing. George is still now very much front and center at Apple, and he is there, and he and Derek Taylor are working, and George is producing, you know, Doris Troy, Billy Preston, the Radhakrishna Temple. He's doing all of that.
He's doing so much studio work in 69. He's doing fantastic stuff in 69. And he's kind of, I think we touched upon this in our All Things Must Pass episode. He's setting himself up. He's just slowly putting together a utility belt of skills.
Yes.
In the studio, and dealing with musicians that do not happen to be friends from Liverpool. He's slowly doing his thing in the background. I don't believe he knew at the time how these skills were going to play out at all. But that's what he is doing. And he's, you know, Paul is kind of moving away from the, oh, here's a song for Mary Hopkin, and here's a song for the Black Dyke Mills Band. And George is actually taking up that mantle.
Yes. And by way of a slight aside, you know how much I admire Philip Norman.
You say he's your favourite. You keep saying
he is. And the last good thing he ever wrote was appeared in the Sunday Times on the 11th of January 1970. But it was based on him hanging around Apple at this time. Just by way of a little aside, he in that article he describes, you know, Derek Taylor, and they're all sort of, you know, people. Some Canadian girl is there trying to get George to listen to a tape, and George is trying to leave the room, and Derek Taylor hands the phone to George and says, they want to know what you look for in a girl. And George, hello, says George, this is John Lennon. I look for spiritual qualities more than physical, though I like girls who don't wear bras. Have you got any shares in Northern songs? Eyes are the windows to the soul, as someone once said. Sorry to have taken up your time. And press the phone down.
So, mocking... It's very funny to just pick up a random phone. Do you have Northern Songs shares? Not, and like, he doesn't even care. He's gotten rid of all his shares. In some ways, he doesn't have a dog in the fight. And knowing fan, sort of his general personality, there's probably part of this where he was like, aren't you glad it isn't me who's having to deal with Northern Songs? I've got me Harry songs over here. And I'm trying to write My Sweet Lord. It's all good. So, but... The first half of September, as we kind of mapped out, is that ATV get their shares up to 38%, John Yoko in Toronto. The second half of September, though, is very different. And George does depart because he gets some news about his mum. His mum has gotten a very serious diagnosis, which she sadly dies the following year. And so he departs up to Liverpool to be with his mum, which leaves behind John, Paul and Ringo. And there is another meeting on the 19th of September.
Yes, at which obviously Yoko and Linda are present, and Klein. And this, we probably, everybody listening to this podcast will have seen the photographs taken at this meeting. These are photographs taken by Linda, and it's the three Beatles and Klein all signing a document and standing around. At one point, Paul is standing there with his thumb down and looking very, you know, screwing up his face, and everybody's kind of joking around and magnifying glasses and all. It's all great larks.
They are fantastic photos. I didn't, like, the first time I saw them a couple of years back, I couldn't believe they kind of existed. You know, because it's John and Yoko. You don't see Linda because she's taking the photos. And as you say, there's one where Paul is kind of comedically glum. And we'll put them up on Twitter, and they're on BeatlesBible.com if you want to go look for them there. But what I always thought for years was that this is a picture of them signing the deal that Klein has set up for EMI. But that's not the case. They're just kind of fake photos.
They're faked up photographs. They're just signing some random piece of paper or some random document. And the whole purpose of the photograph was to reassure people who are watching, specifically the consortium, that all was well in Beetleland, that they were all getting on well. And it, you know, it's all fairly disingenuous because it does create the impression that Paul has signed with Klein and they're all getting on like a house on fire.
Yeah, and, you know, George isn't there. It's very disingenuous because it does seem as if Paul is kind of, you know, signing to Klein almost. It looks like that they are, oh, this is the deal when they all got together. But when they're in the room, they start to discuss what would happen if they managed to get control of Northern Songs, how they would formulate a board of their version of Northern Songs with everybody in the
exactly
room
because Klein is not going to be on the board. That's the point. Now, if you have a hat, take it off or hang on to it very tight because they start to have this discussion and Lee Eastman, who is present, says Paul needs to have voting rights on the board equal to the combined voting rights of the other three Beatles.
What's going on? Why? Like it is a pattern of behaviour we've now established.
Yes, yes.
And
so they're basically saying if Paul has to be in that position, and they said, well, no, this is Klein's report of the meeting. Mm. So Klein says in his affidavit, even Paul was shocked by this. And this was Lee Eastman saying, well, given the way things have gone recently, Paul needs to be sure that he cannot be outvoted. Now, this is very strange, particularly because Paul makes a lot of play about it's an equal partnership, everything has to be unanimous. And again, you get a sense that if Paul is shocked, Lee Eastman is in there sort of trying to protect his client as a client in an arm's length negotiation, which it clearly is not an arm's length negotiation. And apparently, according to Klein, the person who was strongest in voicing his opposition was Ringo. So you know you've not read the room right if Ringo is...
if you've annoyed Ringo.
Yeah.
Well, the thing I wonder is, you know, is Eastman trying to sort of out-Klein Klein in a way? Is he trying to storm in at these meetings and go, oh, you want to see bluster? And, you know, he can't match him. That's not the way he should be doing business, is he? He's just not very good at doing a Klein, Lee Eastman.
But
you know?
I cannot see even the tactical or strategic reason for doing this. You know, there is nothing to be gained by this. They are not signing an agreement. This is simply a discussion which is saying, well, if we get control, how would we constitute the board? And suddenly one of the Beatles is saying, well, I need to have as many votes as the other three combined.
Yeah. Not a great idea. So it doesn't come to pass that way. It goes without saying.
And the meeting broke up.
And the meeting broke up. But you know what they need? They need another meeting the following day.
They do.
Which is the 20th of September, 1969. This is the significant meeting because I think sometimes they're all conflated into one meeting that happens on the day they sign the papers. But it's a separate meeting on the 20th of September. Again, George is away with his ill mother.
Yeah.
And, you know, Klein has kind of cleared out some of the facts of this in affidavit. But this is the day when they come together to sort out the new capital EMI deal. And this is often, as when the story is retold, seen as the saving grace or the great achievement of Klein's stewardship of the Beatles, is that he manages to, you know, get the record label by the Short and Curlies and, you know, with a new album in the pipeline, get a decent royalty rate out of them, which he had done for the Stones before. It's one of his skill sets.
You know, we'll come on to talk about the royalty rate. So that has all been going on in the background. To say all of these things, you treat them separately and you think of them as being sort of discrete standalone topics or issues on meetings, but they're all sort of running into each other and the royalty rate negotiations are going on in the background. The other thing is, I don't think you can separate this meeting from what happened the day before.
It's all the same soup, the same vibes, the same attitudes. Nobody's changing their feeling towards what's going on.
Yeah. So, effectively, the new deal with Capital is revealed and everybody signs. George isn't there. He'll sign a few days later. But John, Paul and Ringo sign. And, you know, this is the point at which Paul will say, well, if you're screwing us over, I can't see how you're doing it.
Yes.
And then they sort of go on to just talk generally about the group and what they're doing. And Paul says, what we should do is go out on tour. We should do a club tour.
That old chestnut. You know, he tried it earlier in the year.
Yeah.
Grand wave of indifference. Yeah.
You know, John says no. And in the Jan Wenner interview in 1970, he sort of says, you know, it got to the point where everything Paul was saying, I was saying no to. So there's a kind of sense that things are building up. And I don't think that Paul necessarily is saying, you know, we should have a club tour, we should do this. I think when John says everything Paul said, I was just saying no to, it's not being specific. It's just a general thing. I just wasn't interested in what Paul was doing and specifically. And then suddenly John says, I wasn't going to say anything until after we'd signed the Capital deal, but I'm leaving the group. So that's it.
That's the bombshell.
That's the bombshell.
And this has been mulling around in his head, you know, for about 2 weeks or so since his travelings to Toronto.
Yes, and as you say, Klein has prevailed upon him, you know, don't say anything, because I'm in this crucial stage of negotiation with Capital. We can't suddenly say, you know, the band is about to split up.
Yeah. And Paul says later, you know, our jaws, me, Ringo, George and Linda nearly dropped it. Like, George wasn't there, so I don't know why he would have said that. Linda was there for some reason.
Well, yeah, the complete quote, if we can have the complete quote.
Oh, yeah, go on.
Our jaws, me, Ringo, George and Linda, because she happened to be nearby, sort of nearby, just like nearby, nearly dropped. So Linda happened to be nearby, because again, one of the things that it's appalling that John is bringing Yoko to all of these meetings.
Yeah.
I mean, I do not condone that, but equally, I do not condone the fact that Paul, almost in a sort of tit-for-tat escalation, is bringing Linda. So
Linda, by the way, who's the mother of a three-week-old at this point, and who probably has better things to be doing.
Probably, you would think.
You would think. And I do think that Paul's head as a new father in September 1969 needs to be taken into account the whole time. It's a crazy world in any person's life, the first 6 weeks of a new infant and then every single week afterwards. But there's a great quote from Ringo, again an anthology quote. After the Plastic Ono Band's debut in Toronto, we had a meeting in Savile Row where John finally brought it to its head. He said, well, that's it, lads, let's end it. And we all said yes. And though I said yes because it was ending, and you can't keep it together anyway, if this is what the attitude is, I don't know if I would have said end it. I probably would have lingered another couple of years. And it's very sort of resigned, you know. I'm leaving, you're leaving. Well, that's it. And, you know, he talks then about if it had happened in 65 or 67, it would have been a mighty shock. But now it's just let's get the divorce over with, really. And John was always the most forward when it came to nailing anything. So he's the leader, John, in this decision.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Ringo is specifically saying, you know, he wasn't shocked. Paul is saying, you know, everybody's jaw dropped. And Ringo is saying, well, I was just relieved. And we talked previously, Ringo was sort of at this point in 1969 is saying, you know, I don't miss being a Beatle. He's already, you know, people are already talking in past tenses. Paul doesn't remember that George wasn't there, but George would say later he doesn't even remember being told about this.
Yeah.
But that's probably, you know, a distraction of his mother's illness.
Yeah, yeah. And as you do, the meeting disperses. John and Yoko and Klein go off for a bit of lunch, and he's given the job of running Bag Productions. And then there's this issue of Abco giving John and Yoko £20,000.
He's so happy to be made company director of Bag Productions.
This becomes an issue later, doesn't it?
This does become an issue later, because what will happen generally going forward as we move into the court case, income is frozen, income is passed into the hands of a receiver. John and Yoko, as we've mentioned before, they don't stop spending. They bought Tittenhurst, they put in their illegal lake,
yeah,
hiring hot air balloons and what have you. Klein will advance money to them. I mean, one of the things that we shouldn't lose sight of is that Klein is an extremely wealthy man in his own right. You know, he was prepared to put up £650,000 of shares in MGM to guarantee the deal. So he lends money to John and Yoko, and you just know that John has no sense that this is really a loan. It's just money. It's back to the guy Stephen Maltz that said you're used to just picking up a phone. You want a car, you want a house, you want a bill paid. And I think it's John's uselessness with money that gets him into trouble with Klein, because Klein will lend money in, and this becomes an issue much, much later.
And in a scene that, you know, if you saw it in a movie, you wouldn't believe it. On the day when they sign this deal with an increased royalty rate, yet somehow John also announces that he's leaving the band, in another room, somewhere else, I guess, in the city, ATV buy shares from the consortium, and they start to reach almost the magical 50% of Northern Songs. So while all this is happening, that's also happening.
Exactly.
And they are trying to get over the line. And that happens just 5 days later. On the 25th of September, ATV increases its shareholding to 54%, and essentially now call off the race. They've won, haven't they?
That's it. Yes, it's all over. They've got 54% and they control the company. End of story. Yeah.
Well, yeah, and Lou Grade sort of calls up a pal, doesn't he, and just says, can I have your shares, more or less?
Yes. Now, I have to say, I have not read Lou Grade's autobiography, Still Dancing, My Story by Sir Lou Grade.
That's my autobiography's name. That's odd.
Oh, very good.
There you go.
I think of you Still as dancing. The Lou Grade of Nothing Is Real.
Yes, cigar time. Go on.
One morning, he says, I called Peter Donald, who by that time had acquired control of Hard and Wyndham Theatres, as well as some theatres in Scotland. He controlled 14% of Northern Songs. I had a strange feeling about Alan Klein because of all these unnecessary delays. So I said, I want to buy 14%. Now, how much do you want for it? We agreed a price, did the deal. We now had over 54% and therefore controlled Northern Songs. Alan Klein called me late that afternoon, and I must give him credit for what he said. He said, well, I have to admit it, you beat me to the punch. We are now ready to sell you the shares at the same price you paid Peter Donald. He said he'd been considering doing the deal with Donald himself, but obviously had left it too late. And that, my friends, is how we acquired the Beatles catalogue and got into the music business.
It's and that's a story of How I'm Great by Lou Grade. And that's it. Yeah, so they now have 54%. But there's what we'll come to in a second is there's now this merry dance of what the Beatles will do with the percentage that they own. But again, the following day, we get Abbey Road hitting the shops. You know, it's still business as usual.
Still business as usual.
It's so amusing. And, Barry Miles, just to pull a quote, by the time Abbey Road was completed, Alan Klein had reduced Apple to an ordinary management office. All the fine ideals were gone, as well as most of the idealists. It's still functioning, though.
It's still functioning. I mean, it's a record label. It's putting out records. It has a roster of artists. It's got a great studio that will go on to be a great studio in the early 70s. And, you know, Elton John, T-Rex, all the, you know, record there. People use it to record demos. Yeah. You know, it's not true to say it had just become the equivalent of NAMS, let's say.
But I think it is fair to say there's probably roughly a 100% reduction in Hell's Angels. Roughly.
I think 100% reduction in Hell's Angels. And I think probably 99.999% reduction in the Idealists. I think probably only Derek Taylor was still holding the line.
And so as Abbey Road hits the stores, the business papers, the music business papers, are reporting that Northern Songs has kind of fallen to ATV. They've managed to broker the percentage that they need to get to the magic 50%.
Yes. And as you say, the Beatles then have to decide, what are they going to do? Are they going to stay with this company as minority shareholders? They won't necessarily have a representation on the board. They will get income as shareholders, but Klein comes up with a proposal. Now, I think this is a very good deal given the circumstances that they find themselves in. So he goes back to ATV and Lou Grade, and the broad lines are that ATV would buy all of the Beatles' shares in Northern Songs, but for a mixture of cash and shares in ATV. So the Beatles would still then have an interest, and they would be all of the litigation that was ongoing against Northern Songs would finish. John and Paul would re-sign. If you remember, their publishing deal with Northern Songs ran until 1973. They would re-sign and extend that out to 1976. George and Ringo would switch from their deals with Harris Songs and Startling Music, which is sort of assigned to Apple Publishing. They would also sign to 1976. And if you remember, the first 56 songs were controlled by Lenmac, and that had been sold into Northern Songs. The Beatles would get that back. Or sorry, John and Paul would get that back. And Apple would get sub-publishing rights in the US. So it's similar. You know, this is again a deal which gives them direct income from America, gives them a shareholding in the parent company ATV. This is a good deal.
Yeah. So ATV have just over 50%. The Beatles have just under 30%.
Yeah.
Do they trundle along? They could have just done nothing and kept their 30% and seen what was gone. But should they transfer that 30% for a given percentage of ATV, like say 20% of ATV, plus some cash, plus some other rights, and all the you know, bad litigation goes away? They get some songs back, but they keep writing songs until 1976. So it is a deal. You know, it's, you know, they could have kept their powder dry, done nothing, and tried to buy out ATV in a few years down the line, and you know, and be kind of belligerent with their third of shares, or they could hitch their wagon to the train and, you know, make hay for everybody. So let's
do that then. Let's
let's do that. And there's absolutely nobody who's going to come along and just kind of throw some kind of fuel onto the fire, who's going to stick a stick in the spokes of the bike of this deal.
Turn the page.
Oh, Lee Eastman.
Lee Eastman won't let Paul sign the deal.
And did he have a better deal in mind?
No, not that I can see.
It doesn't seem to. It seems to be the whole point. It's not like, well, don't sign. Actually, we could do this. It seems to be just like, no, don't sign.
Yeah, don't sign. And there's a very good book by Brian Southall it's incredibly detailed. And, you know, but if you really, really want to dig down into the legal background to Northern Songs, this is the book. But he says, simply because it was a deal negotiated by Klein, that is the reason why they wouldn't sign it. So again, it seems to come back to this personal animosity between Eastman and Klein, between the Eastman camp and the Klein camp. He did it, we're not signing it. Good deal, bad deal, don't care, we're not signing it.
And the kind of ramifications of this spill out to today, because Paul forever has had his heart set on owning the Beatles' rights, getting them back, particularly, and we could do a whole episode on the afterlife of these songs, but the big flag in the sand is eventually Michael Jackson takes them over, and that's kind of a dagger to the heart of Paul, and he has spent many years in the courts trying to sort that. And this goes back to these decisions made in October 1969, because, you know, Lou Grade says, you know, they were crazy not to take a stake in ATV and not to have kind of a stake in the future of their own work, you know, and the future earning potential of their own work, and having a say at the table in how their own work was controlled. And, you know, the other interesting part about the deal is we're assuming Harrison and Ringo were ready to go along with transferring their...
It seems to be. You know, and as you say, George had no skin in the game. You know, Ringo was going to get a payout because he still had his 40,000 from the flotation. George didn't have any shares. He'd sold them. Paddy Harrison had 1,000 shares. But George seems to have been, on board. And everybody on the ATV side is sort of saying it was a good deal for both sides. Heads of agreement were drawn up. This is Jack Gill, the financial director. Heads of agreement were drawn up with our respective lawyers. Klein couldn't get the Eastmans and Paul to agree. John and Lee Eastman stopped the deal. They would not let Paul be a party to an agreement negotiated by Klein on behalf of all the Beatles. Klein was sorry, I was sorry, because part of the deal was that we'd have got Harrison and Ringo, who at the time really didn't mean much. Of course, George Harrison has since been a great success as a songwriter.
But what's really crazy is what they do next, which is they almost like throw their toys out of the pram and it's like, okay, we'll sell our shares. We'll just get rid of them.
Yeah. So they basically say, okay, we'll make a sim offer, just under £2, and we'll sell. But by this time, ATV, who don't really want to part with cash, they say, no, you're fine. We don't want your shares. We don't need your shares. But the City Takeover Panel, which is a sort of regulatory body that ensures all shareholders are treated equally, said, no. You've got to propose to the Beatles and all of the other minority shareholders, because there are still other people. You have to make the same offer as you made to the consortium. So that is what happens. They make that offer.
And they go off, they make the offer, they buy the Beatles shares, and that's kind of what happens. It's all finalised by the end of the year, essentially, that they go after the minority stakeholders. By the end of the year, they're up to 96% of shares. They've got the Beatles shares as well. And they reach 99% ownership in January 1970. But I love this notion that there's 1% of Beatles fans who can't be located.
Yes.
In order to, these people we spoke about in an early episode who went off and bought their own shares. That is the end result. But this doesn't really go through until October. It's October when the news breaks that this is the thing. And October is a difficult month because Paul and Ringo and their respective wives are still going out socializing at the same time. They go see Mary Hopkin in the Savoy. But the 22nd of October, this is the date when actually it all breaks. It all goes public. Everything comes out.
Yeah. So this goes, so ATV publicly announced that they've decided to acquire the Beatles shares. Paul goes to Scotland. So he sort of disappears off the scene. And the Paul is dead. Rumours start to gather pace on that day. But the deal goes through and they pay cash. So ATV actually pay cash for the Beatles shares, whereas they had paid in stock for the consortium shares. So this was really because there was a threatened lawsuit for $5 million against Northern Songs, and ATV decide, well, look, we'll just pay cash, we get rid of all of that. And Ringo gets 80,000, and Paul and John get $1.5 million each.
It's extraordinary. And again, in the movie of the Beatles, you wouldn't believe that all this happens on the same day. Paul goes off to Scotland to become this different type of guy. The ATV board, you know, get this announcement. The news comes to Apple via the Financial Times. And, it's reported, if we look at the press office release, it says, on behalf of the Beatles and their company, Apple Corps, their business manager, Alan Klein of Abco Industries, after discussion with the Beatles, announced in New York today that all negotiations between the Beatles, ATV and Northern Songs have been terminated by the Beatles. All of the Beatles and their companies intend to sell all their shares in Northern Songs to ATV at a price in accordance with the terms laid down by the takeover panel. John Lennon and Paul McCartney have no intention of involving themselves in any further relationship with Northern Songs or Associated Television beyond the fulfilment of their songwriting contract to February 1973. And we know that there's ramifications to that as well when Paul brings Linda in as a songwriter to give MPL a chunk of the publishing.
Yep.
You know, famously, John's last appearance is a salute to Lou Grade on American TV in 1975 as a contractual obligation to Lou Grade. This is the beginning of another thing.
It is. And that's the appearance where he has his band wear a mask on the back of their head as a kind of two-faced comment on Lou Grade. And as you say, yes, Linda will start writing with Paul. So half of the royalties for the Paul and Linda co-writes goes to Linda's publishing company and doesn't go near Lou Grade. And strangely, around the same time, John starts writing with Yoko, so that half of his songwriting goes to Yoko's publisher. And this causes all sorts of ramifications and lawsuits, and it leads to the James Paul McCartney special.
That is another contractual obligation to Lou Grade.
We
exactly
have
right.
Lou Grade to thank for that as well.
And part of that contractual obligation is that he has to do a certain quotient of Beatles songs. They're the first public Beatles songs that Paul performs when he's a solo person. So that's why he does that medley, is just to knock out a couple of Beatles songs to keep the ATV consortium happy.
And I think I also worked out that the other person who got some money is Patty Harrison. I think she gets about £2,000.
Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
Not bad at all.
And so all of that is the, you know, by the last week in October 1969. So, Stephen, could I do a little synopsis at this point?
I'd be more than happy to listen to that.
On January the 27th, 1969, Alan Klein met John and Yoko for the first time. It is now October the 22nd, 1969, just 9 months later. The Beatles are at number one with Abbey Road. Apple in Savile Row has changed from the fun London townhouse that we all saw in the Get Back film to have had the bulk of its staff fired and has been reorganised into an efficient record label and publishing company. But however, the purchase of NEMS has grasped defeat from the jaws of victory. Northern Songs has gotten away from them in a series of events that still has ramifications in the courtrooms of the 21st century. And yes, a deal had been renegotiated with EMI for increased royalties, but not for any recording rights. And when signed, there was no Beatles left to record. John, Paul, George and Ringo were never in the same room again. 9 months in 1969 with Alan Klein.
That's very impressive recap.
And thank you very much.
It's not dissimilar to my recap.
Oh, you have a recap too.
I have a recap too.
Oh, okay, then let's hear your recap.
So following Alan Klein meeting with John and Yoko in the Dorchester at the end of January 1969, the battle for control of NEMS was lost following John Eastman's letter to Clive Epstein referencing the impropriety of negotiations between NEMS and the Beatles, which sent NEMS into the arms of the Triumph Investment Trust. The battle to obtain Northern Songs were indeed a series of misadventures, the first being Paul's refusal to put up the shares to guarantee the loan necessary to complete the deal, the request by Lee Eastman for weighted voting rights on the Northern Songs board, and the fact that Paul and the Eastmans would not sign the ATV deal, which would have given the Beatles shares in ATV, the return of the first 56 songs to Lenmac, and Klein finally got his contract after working for 3 months without any official documentation. So not a dissimilar recap, I think.
But what do you think, everybody? Look, there is still an afterlife. Alan Klein doesn't exit the picture at this point. There is further tales of Alan Klein and the Beatles to be told. But this is the end, you could say, of Alan Klein with the Beatles as a unit, who are a functioning group of people actively recording and releasing records. It transitions into something else towards the end of 1969. That's a reasonable thing to say, isn't it?
I think so. And I'd also, in much the same way that Paul disappeared to Scotland, I'd like to announce that I'm taking a short break from social media as a result of this episode and recap.
Yeah, you might want to hand over the reins of Facebook to somebody else with your staunch defence of Alan Klein right there. Just for the record, Stephen thinks Alan's great. No. But what do you think, everybody? It's an extraordinary story. It reinforces how much can happen in such a short period of time in the universe of the Beatles. And we're always happy to discuss it in all the usual places. We're available on Twitter at BeatlesPod.com, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group run by Stephen. www.nothingisrealpod.com is the website. And we have bonus episodes to go with these ones on Acast Plus. And we want to thank all our Acast Plus supporters for supporting us along the way. And you might want to check out some of the things that we have in store there. But for now, my name is Jason Carty.
My name is Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.